Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. What do you do when you love dogs, love shopping, and a global pandemic presents you with a lot of time? For two Vermont women, you create an online store called Life in Labradors. What could be more logical? At the same time, they hope that their efforts will also do good. We're going to meet one of the two founder owners of Life in Labradors and spend the next half hour learning about the business. Jen Wyman, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you very much.
Great to have you. Now, listeners, if you'd like to ask Jen about the business or to share your love of labs, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255, or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. I have to make sure I don't call you Jane Wyman. Jen Wyman. All right. I think I'll get it.
Yes.
All right. Great. Now, Jen, explain what Life in Labradors is.
Well, it is what we hope to be a fun and functional website that women and men alike can find products to enhance their lives, clothe their bodies, and then also enjoy a love of dogs. Now, we all have Labradors, so we called it Life in Labradors, but we always make sure to say that you don't have to have a lab to enjoy the products that we sell.
Okay, gotta love dogs, not necessarily just labs, although you do love labs.
Yes, we do.
All right. How do you describe the website to people who haven't visited it yet?
Well, I think Rachel and I have always loved storytelling, and I like websites that invite you in and include them in their story. I know that, and some listeners will remember, Jay Peterman had a wonderful catalog and website years and years ago, but each item had its own story, and you learned about the craftsman behind the product. And so we have tried to do that as much as we can with our site, is tell the story, include the customers in the stories, and hopefully intrigue them enough that they may try some of them.
Yeah, and for Seinfeld fans who are late to the party, the Jay Peterman catalog was a real thing, and it actually was brilliant. It was one of they had the wonderful drawings of the product, and incredible descriptions of where they came from. So that's a great model to go on.
Yeah, it drew you in, and it really, even if you didn't buy anything, you were still a part of their story, and you became a part of their community, which we can only hope that we might generate a small portion of that loyalty.
Now, when I think of business ideas, a website selling items for your dog or with cute dog images and neat lifestyle stuff, that doesn't pop into my mind automatically. So where did you and Rachel come up with the idea?
Well, she and her husband had always talked about doing that. We want to find some website or store that has this, or we should do something like this. And so it's always been in the back of our minds. I have managed retail over the years, and we both love shopping. And so when COVID came, and I have a consulting business, so unfortunately lost quite a few of my clients, she is now running her family's import business. So she was still busy and viable. She and her husband just decided, well, we have the funding, you have the time, let's go for it. So it might not have been the most thought out, carefully planned venture, but we knew that we would start small and start smart and see where it went. So we did.
And when did you launch?
We launched July of last summer.
Oh, so after the pandemic had started, you said we're going to bravely go ahead on this. Let's talk about dogs for a little bit. Why do you love Labradors so much?
I don't know. It's just, I personally, I grew up with Corgis, so that's the farthest thing from a Labrador.
Yeah.
But my husband and I, when we first started dating, decided that we would get a little black lab. And it's just been an obsession, a love. We actually currently have two rescues, which is new for us, and a whole set of challenges, but they have black lab in them. Rachel has always had purebred chocolate, and now she's got a little tiny chocolate female and a big yellow lab. So there's something about Labradors. I think they're very American. I know they've been at the top of the most popular dog in the U.S. for years. I love their personalities. Mm-hmm. I love their gentleness. It's, you know, I think everyone sort of settles on a dog type, and we did that.
Yeah, you do. You get kind of an image of what a dog should be, what they should look like, how they should act, and that's your dog. And if it's Dalmatian, then it's Dalmatian. But in your case, exactly. It's Lab. And Jen, I think I may be mistaken, but I think you even when you adopted the rescues, you said they have to at least look like Labs.
I know, and that's horrible of me, but there are enough rescues out there that I didn't feel that I was being too discriminatory. And yes, that was the stipulation, is we wanted a black lab lookalike or mix to keep those personality traits going.
All right. Now, let's get back to life in Labradors. So what is your business background?
I was in marketing and PR for years at a resort, so always have been in hospitality since college, and that carried a lot of different hat-wearing positions. I managed retail. I managed some food and beverage. So I had a little bit of everything, and then Rachel had a solid background in HR, leaving that behind to purchase and start running her family's import. So she certainly has great experience being a woman business owner and part of that community. I come from a family of creative women, and I've always enjoyed shopping for others, so it was a great combination.
That is a perfect background for this. And how did you and Rachel get together to eventually decide this is the person that I want to do life in Labradors with?
We have a very interesting relationship in that we have very similar tastes, but yet very different tastes, and somehow it works. Common goals, common enjoyments. I think that we've done a really good job of being able to choose things together that one of us may not agree on. But it was nerve-wracking going into it, going, is this going to ruin our friendship? So I think the two of us have tried very hard to make sure that we are very open and honest and really know that our personal opinions are important. But in the end, it's what our potential customers want and could possibly need, that is the most important.
Now, I don't know if anyone told you, we are in this global pandemic, and I'm wondering, first of all, if you didn't think maybe we should wait and not launch and not go forward at this time, wait for another time to get going with this website.
Right. When I struck out on my own in the marketing field, I became a member of something called Women on Vermont Womenpreneurs. And just really got immersed in Vermont's community of women business owners and watching their stories and seeing what they were doing. And it's a really amazing organization because it really does highlight Vermont and its incredible group of women business owners and allows us to learn from their mistakes, learn from their successes, bounce things off each other. I think I saw during the pandemic was a really strong, and not just on a Vermont level, but a national level, a really strong engagement with small business, intriguing products. People were making efforts to really support the small business person. And it was odd to me that spending didn't seem to slow down, even though we were facing unemployment and everything was unknown. There was a real uprising in supporting retail. It was odd. I know that I certainly tried my best to support local, and the local business owners were wonderful in doing remote drop-offs, and everyone scrambled to get online billing and takeout. So we didn't, it was certainly a factor that we thought about, but at the same time, we said we both have other jobs that we're working on. This isn't going to be our only source of income, and I had the time to build the website and do all of that legwork, which Rachel did not. So it was perfect timing for us in the end, and I don't think that we suffered because of it. Certainly, we weren't not having this site be our single source of income and counting on it to feed our families was a huge factor.
All right, Jen, let's get to the part I really love. I do love shopping, so let's go shopping and take us and let's introduce us to some of the things you've got at Life in Labrador's.
Well, when Rachel and I started talking about our product offerings, we decided that we would try to stay within a few different parameters that we really believed in. The first four or five top ones that we had were women-owned, small-batch companies. Made in the U.S. was important. We know it's not always possible, but certainly when possible, we want to support our communities. Not on Amazon, and I don't discount Amazon. I am an Amazon Prime holder, but we wanted to have that be one of our stipulations so that at least our products were not competing with that monster. We wanted to look at possible social good companies and handmade when possible. Again, not everything is going to be within those, but we wanted to at least have those as some of our priorities.
And so why, really Jen? Why were you really committed to these parameters?
Well, we felt that, A, we would not have to be fighting with larger websites with a much larger marketing and advertising budget, a much stronger reach in the digital world, and it meant something to us.
Gotcha. All right. So I know you love to shop, and you love to be a personal shopper. So let's saunter around the website and show me a few things.
Sure. Well, one of our favorites is in the home section, and certainly the website is a work in progress as we figure out how people maneuver it and how people best find things. So we are always trying to shift that around. But Dot and Army is a wonderful company in Georgia, and everything is handmade, and they concentrate on home goods. They have these wonderful dish scrubbies, and Lord knows they're not glamorous, but let's face it, we all use them.
Right.
And they're handmade, they're durable, they can be thrown in the dishwasher, they're wonderful colors, and it's a small woman-owned family company. They're small batch, they're eco-friendly, and they're fun. They're attractive, they're fun, and to be supporting a fellow entrepreneur is satisfying. We also have from them, as we all know from being on social media during the pandemic, everyone started baking bread, people who never thought they would, everyone. So we have a wonderful set of theirs, that's a bread maker set. It's a handmade linen bread bag and then a bowl cover for your proofing and raising of your dough. Again, they use wonderful fabrics and they use wonderful colors. And it's just, it's really nice to be able to enjoy some of the more mundane things in life, like doing dishes, with beautiful products.
Dish scrubbies that are fun is probably something I, when I woke up this morning, I did not think I'd be talking about, and I'm really happy that I am. And I have seen the bread kit on your site, and I love that. Now, you know, it's a big world out there, and you have a very specific list of parameters, you know, that you're looking for. So how do you select and find these vendors and products?
Well, certainly, we don't want to have to make large inventory orders, or nor do we have the space nor the large captive market to supply them. So there are some wonderful retail digital showrooms or virtual showrooms where you can go and you can really pinpoint the type of products that you want. So you can go in and you can select women-owned, small batch, made in the U.S., and they sort it for you, and they provide this list of vendors that have subscribed to them, obviously. So you're not going to find everybody. But we have found a really nice selection, and then that allows us to go out and find others. But we are certainly looking for, you know, specific vendors. Vermont certainly has a lot. Rachel's currently in New York, just across the lake, and they've got the Adirondacks have a wonderful community as well.
We call that Vermont West, so.
Yeah, exactly. so it isn't as hard as it seems.
What has been the best part of this new venture for you?
Knowing that we can make it work. Knowing that we did something that we never thought we would. And I have to say, it's always been satisfying to buy things not knowing whether everyone else will like them and then have them walk out of the store or off the website with someone and hear that they really enjoyed it in their life. And if we've learned nothing else from COVID, it's to embrace now and really look around you and see what you're living and how you're living. And in a very small part, I like to be a part of that.
Mm-hmm. You said that, you know, knowing that it would work was a big, really big thing for you. When did you know? What point did that happen? You know, was it immediately you launched and all of a sudden you had, you know, followers and people jumping in? Did it take months? Was it, you know, the Christmas rush? Where did it happen where you said, ah, yes, they like life in Labradors?
I don't know that I feel that way yet.
Come on, Jen.
Certainly the first few orders were very gratifying, but I think that we both know there's lots more room to grow, and finding the time to really spend on it and make sure that we don't lose our core values along the way is important. And I'm just happy knowing that somebody has ordered something. Obviously, it would be wonderful if this went and grew exponentially, but right now we're just having fun learning about it, learning how to be successful online, which is a huge, huge arena. And I'm not sure that I can say we've gotten there yet.
Mm. Hey, we really haven't talked too much about a dog something, so help me pick out a dog product that you've got there at Life in Labradors.
Well, I will say that, let's see. I really like the products that we have from this company called Walton Wood Farm. It ticked all the boxes for us in terms of women-owned, small batch, et cetera. But they also have some of the most creative and hysterical marketing I've ever seen. They have some freshening sprays. They have doggy wipes. We also have some body care items from them that are pretty amazing. They have this great product called Boys Don't Stink.
Yes, I saw that. Interesting.
Yes. It is absolutely wonderful, and I gave my teenage son a bottle immediately. But it also works. It also works very well for stinky dogs, as you know, as we are in the middle of mud season, mm-hmm. we all know what that can be like.
Yeah.
But again, they have incredible marketing, and they're just fun, and they're humorous, and they have amazing products for everyone to use.
And how about the vision for the future of life in Labradors?
I think for now we're going to continue on the path that we're on, which is just keeping inventory small, changing seasonally, finding the best way to get life in Labradors out there. We both follow some companies that started off like us and now are much larger, and we're not sure whether that's where we want to go. But we're having fun learning.
Well, another thing that's fun at the website is that you have a blog on the site. So what kind of stuff will people find there?
Ooh, we're not very good at the blog. I'll be completely honest.
I love the recipes.
The recipes, yeah. We definitely made an effort to do things over the holidays. I think that what we had hoped and will continue to work towards is just sharing some stories about our lives, being mothers, being working wives, being dog owners, some funny stories about them. But I typically have to push Rachel because she doesn't trust that she's funny and she's hysterical. So it's hard doing it all ourselves and having families and other businesses. But again, that's one of those things you have to learn, that if your customers will become more loyal or you'll generate more customers because of it, you have to make time for it.
Yeah. Jen Wyman is one of the founder owners of Life in Labradors, which you can find at lifeandlabradors.com. Jen, thanks for being on with me this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure thing. We're going to take a break for CBS News Update, then return to talk with the owner of a dairy farm that was way ahead of its time. And this morning at 10:30, we've got a big cheese announcement. That's all I can say, a big cheese announcement. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Dairy farmers have been told for the last 5-10 years they need to diversify. Maybe they should tap into something called agritourism, and it would really help to adopt green practices. Now, please don't think them rude if the folks who run a certain farm in the lovely town of Rochester scoff a little and say, "What took you all so long?" I'm referring to the Liberty Hill Farm and Inn, run by Beth and Bob Kennett. And Beth joins us now to talk about their dairy operation. Beth, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, Rick. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, it's great to have you. You're probably the cheeriest person I've spoken to today. It's great to talk to you. Listeners, if you've got a question for Beth about what they're doing at Liberty Hill Farm, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You can let us know if you are familiar with Liberty Hill. Maybe you've even stayed there. Let us know that as well. Beth, give us a brief sweeping tour of Liberty Hill Farm.
Wow. Okay. Liberty Hill Farm was settled in 1780 by John Emerson, and his grandson was born and raised here on Liberty Hill and went off to make his fame and fortune, and was Dr. Charles Wesley Emerson, who founded Emerson College in Boston.
Oh, my.
Dr. Emerson came back up in the late 1800s and kind of reacquired all his grandfather's land holdings. And then he built our five-story old barn that's just an iconic fixture. We call it a cathedral of the countryside. Mm. It's just this wonderful, the big red barn. And the cow weather vane on top of the cupola was manufactured in Cambridge, Massachusetts in 1888, and Dr. Emerson brought it up here and affixed it on top of this wonderful old barn. So that's a quick history of this farm. Bob and I moved here to buy the farm in 1979. We're only the fifth family to have owned this farm since 1780.
Oh, my gosh.
So that's kind of cool. And yeah. We farm here with our son David and his wife Asha and their four children. And it's really, you know, just that iconic small family dairy farm in the middle of the Green Mountains in the hills of Vermont on the White River. You couldn't get a more classic location.
Oh, I love it.
I think that has been helpful for us in the attraction of hosting guests here since 1984. So we've had, you know, over 37 years of hosting guests on our farm from across the country and all around the world.
Oh, that's fantastic. I love the Emerson College connection. Last week, I had Brent Hollenbach on from the Burlington Free Press, and he had written a story about Boston University, which started in Newbury, Vermont. I think it was a small seminary school, and then eventually moved to Boston, eventually became Boston College. And now we've got this Emerson College connection with Vermont as well. I love hearing that. When you took over in 79, you and Bob, what motivated you? What were you farmers already, or did you just decide this is a thing we want to do?
Yes, so Bob grew up in New Hampshire and on a dairy farm, and he went to the University of New Hampshire and majored in dairy science, then went into the Marine Corps. And when he got out of the Marine Corps, he knew that he didn't want to, that he wanted to go back to farming. So he actually came and got a job on my father's farm in Maine, and I grew up on the farm in Maine that had been in my family since the 1600s. So we both have dairy farming in our background, and he ended up marrying the farmer's daughter.
I love
and
it.
And we moved to Addison, Vermont in 1975, and we were there for a couple of years, went back down to Maine, and then really looked for a farm of our own to purchase, and found this farm here in Rochester in 1979. So
wow.
We moved here in March of 79. Milking at the time was about 40 cows, and now we're up to 120 registered Holsteins. And we have been part of the Cabot Creamery Cooperative not only since we moved here, but both of our fathers in New Hampshire and in Maine had been part of the what was called Yankee Milk Cooperative when we were kids and then became Agrimark. And so we've really been members of that same milk cooperative for our entire lives. So it's just, that's kind of cool too.
What roots. This is really phenomenal. I love it. Now, you got the farm in 79. By 84, you really were kind of ahead of your time, I keep saying. In what ways did you diversify at Liberty Hill?
Well, you know, in 1979, when we moved here, we had two babies. Our older son, Tom, was two, and our younger son, David, was 6 months old.
Oh.
So it just took us, you know, a little bit of time to get our feet under us. But then in the early 80s, there was a significant downturn in the economy, both for everyone and specifically in the dairy economy. And we needed to diversify in order to survive and keep the farm going. And you kind of utilize the assets that you have. And what we had here was a big, huge farmhouse with 10 bedrooms, and we were not going to have 10 children. So it was a way of our being able to utilize those assets and for me to still be able to work with Bob on the farm and take care of our children and all of that. So really, it was you know, we were really fortunate. We're also fortunate in that Rochester is right in the middle of ski country. Mm-hmm. And as I said, we're right on the White River, surrounded by Green Mountain National Forest. So it's just a lovely location. And Route 100 is really one of the scenic highways in the state of Vermont. When you go from the Massachusetts border to the Canadian border, Rochester is exactly like the halfway point. Mm-hmm. And easy access to, you know, the Appalachian Trail and the Long Trail. And it's just an amazing location for us to be able to have attract people to come and visit the farm. What was really interesting to me when we started taking in guests in February of 84, I really thought, you know, well, we'd have skiers and that would be about it. And I really thought that we were a bed, you know. And we learned very quickly that it's all about the cows, of course.
Wow. You know?
I mean, yeah, it's the cows. It has nothing to do with, you know, pillows. And even though I make great pancakes, that's kind of secondary, it's really all about the cows.
So agritourism, was that your idea, or did it turn out to be the guests who were staying, you know, at your inn who kind of said, we want to know more about what's going on here on the farm?
It really was the guests. They really pushed that part of it. You know, when you think about agritourism, I mean, you're very, very kind to say that I was ahead of my time, but I was really 100 years late. Because Rochester in the late 1800s, when Dr. Emerson was here, he would have all his buddies come up from Boston on the train. Mm. And we had the Peavine Railroad came up from Bethel up through the valley and had the roundhouse in the village of Rochester where it would come and turn around and head back to Boston. And Dr. Emerson had his own little whistle stop right here on our road where he could come up from Boston, bring all his friends. And they would stay here, you know, so this was a happening place 100 years ago.
The end of the line from Boston.
Yeah.
How about that? Well, you know, I'm sure if you had the opportunity to have spoken with Dr. Emerson, you would have caught on a little quicker as to what you should have been doing with the farm. But, yeah.
And farm families, really, in the 1920s and 30s, I mean, the railroads, if you go of Vermont tourism. It was connected with the railroads 100 years ago, and they had this whole deal with the railroad company helping finance the precursor to the Vermont Life magazine, encouraging people to come up on the railroads and visit and have farm families host them. Yeah. So there's really a long, long history for this. It's not necessarily new. The term agritourism is new, but the idea of people coming to the countryside and being hosted by farm families. Mm. And the other piece of that is that it used to be that families would come and visit Grandpa on the farm or Uncle Joe. Oh,
right.
And Grandpa and Uncle Joe aren't on the farm anymore. No. You know, I'm sure we don't want to get into the whole demographics of dairy farming in Vermont, but when we started farming here in Rochester in 1979, there were 11 dairy farms in the valley shipping milk, and we've been the last dairy farm in Rochester to ship milk in almost 20 years. And, you know, the number of dairy farms in Vermont has significantly decreased in the last 10 years. So people
true.
Can't go visit Uncle Joe's farm or, you know, go home to Grandma and Grandpa. So Bob has joked for years now that they come home to Grammy Bath. So it's Uncle Bob and Aunt Bath, or Grammy and Grandpa here, and we provide that family connection for folks from all over. One of the fascinating things to me, Rick, has been during this pandemic, people from all kinds of backgrounds have wanted to come and visit the farm. And we've been closed for almost 9 months out of the past year, but the governor allowed us to be open very, very minimally last summer with really significantly reduced occupancy. So we might have a couple or, you know, a very small family of four here at a time, instead of, you know, that we usually have two or three families here at a time, and we did not. We had like one family here at a time last summer, and it would be a family of four. So very, very reduced occupancy. But what was fascinating to me was that people whose family roots might have come from other continents around the world, they would walk in and say that it reminded them of their grandparents.
Oh, wow.
And I was blown away how this happened time after time after time. People would be weeping, saying they couldn't visit their family, they couldn't go to India, or they couldn't go to South America, or they couldn't go to Europe, and they would come here and start weeping and saying that this just so reminded them of their grandma's farm on some other continent.
Oh, wow,
Rick,
Beth.
It's amazing.
That's
the
incredible.
The connection that people have to the land, to farming, to family. And we have been so honored and so blessed to be able to provide that connection to people. It's just an amazing, amazing thing to me.
That is amazing. And let's go to the phones. Jim's joining us from Barrie. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good morning. I want to congratulate you on your success with that, because it's very dear to my heart. I wished you around when I moved here in 86, because my goal when I moved here was I bought a farm over by Greensboro, and I was going to do exactly what you're doing. And you can see a picture in your head, I'm sure, of where I was coming from. I grew up going to my family farm in South Dakota, which was a grain and cattle farm. And I wanted to recreate my childhood. That's what it was all about. And I ultimately concluded that I just didn't have the financial wherewithal to do the marketing part of it, because I kept saying, no one's going to come up and find us here in Greensboro, Vermont. Well, after I got out of it, shortly after I got out of it, the state of Vermont published this agritourism brochure with all the farms that accept guests. Oh. And that would have been the perfect start. But anyway, the question I have for you is, one of the parts I never was able to think through was safety on the farm. I mean, I wanted to have them going out in the field, picking up bales of hay, throwing bales up on the wagon, riding on the drawbar on tractors, or you know, cultivating in the field. Not here, they don't do that, but riding on the fenders, you know, for hours in the fields doing something, chasing cattle. I mean, all kinds of stuff.
Sure.
That was part of it, but I don't think you could let a guest do that without, you know, having crazy liability.
Well, Jim, let's let Beth get to this, because you, first of all, I love that Beth, Jim had the same vision. I wish his had taken off as well, but he didn't quite get there. But you do allow guests to, and you have, I think, young people come and take tours of the farm. So where's that line of letting them become part of what you're doing, and also making sure that it remains within the bounds of safety?
Well, Jim, thank you so much. That's a fantastic question. And I was one of the ones that helped put together that brochure that you saw in 86.
Nice.
And we hosted workshops on agritourism throughout the state of Vermont for quite a number of years, more than 20 years. And we always included having an insurance agent come and talk to us about risk management, about liability, about how you conduct farm safety. And we currently are doing that again. There's information on the uvm.edu website for agritourism about farm safety issues. I have been very fortunate over the years to work really, really closely with our insurance agent. And I think that that's one of the primary factors that farmers have to consider, is that relationship with your insurance agent and ensuring that you have safety signs up and that you're not letting people ride on the fenders, Jim. Sorry. that's really a no-no. There's a lot of things that in your list of what you want people to do that you really can't do.
Right.
But I think it's, you know, ensuring that your farm is as safe as possible and that you really are thoughtful. right now with COVID-19, we've got signs up for, you know, hand washing and social distancing and wearing masks. There's all kinds of safety. In, you know, years ago, we had the whole biosecurity scares on behalf of the animals. So we've had, you know, hand washing signs up for actually years. So safety on the farm for many reasons is absolutely critical.
Beth, what is the
question, Jim?
Yeah, it is a great question, and you know, it's never too late, Jim. We still are loved by people who'd love to come and visit Vermont. What is the Liberty Hill Center for Agricultural Education?
That is, we've been fortunate to have been encouraged by people to create that, and my daughter-in-law Asha does farm tours that are completely separate from my offering the farm vacation, farm stay experience. So I provide lodging and meals to people who want to come and stay with us, whether they stay for a weekend or a week or however long. Most guests are here 3 to 10 days. Asha, through the Liberty Hill Center for Ag Education, can provide a farm tour that's just a couple of hours. It's a snapshot of the farm, and she explains, you know, dairy farm life, and allows people to, you know, feed a baby calf, do some of those things on Jim's list, but certainly not all the things on Jim's list.
Gotcha. Now, on your website, I believe people can support one of your 140 cows there at Liberty Hill.
They can, absolutely, yeah. It's just a way for people to be able to engage with us and help keep the farm going. We really feel very blessed that there's a lot of folks who really want to be a part of our farm family in whatever way they can. So this provides them that opportunity. Right now we're working on some fundraising to fix up that 5-story barn and fix the cupola on it to put it back to its former glory. And so that's a way for people to be able to help us with that. I think one of the other components of our having being engaged in agritourism, Rick, is that it allows us to connect people to, you know, the Cabot Creamery Cooperative and our Cabot products. I think that after folks have stayed here, they love being able to go home and go in their grocery store and find our Cabot cheese.
Mm-hmm.
And it's another way of connecting to the farm. So they can connect to the farm either through our Center for Ag Ed or coming and visiting and staying. But then when they go home, they also get to connect to the farm by buying Cabot products that they know our cows made the milk for the Cabot Co-op.
And it's great
that there's all these wonderful ways that people can connect and feel like they're part of our farm family.
I'm going to mention one more thing because we have just about a minute, Beth. But you have the Rochester Farm Explorers. Now, who are they?
So Asha provides like a kind of a summer camp program so that kids not just in Rochester but throughout the entire area can sign up and come and do projects during the week. So it's the Farm Explorers is just a way for she has specific programs that she puts on with local elementary school age kids, and that's a way for them to come and be part of the farm because, again, we're the only dairy farm left in the valley, and it's really a wonderful way for kids to come and learn about agriculture and learn about dairy farming in Vermont.
Beth Kennett and her husband, Bob, own the Liberty Hill Farm and Inn in Rochester, which is a lovely town. And as you mentioned right off the bat, that just driving up and down Route 100, if you have never done it from one end to the other, listeners, oh, you must. You can visit the website of Liberty Hill Farm. It is called libertyhillfarm.com, and you can learn more about what they do and what they have to offer. Beth, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Rick, for having me. It's a delight to be on your show and to talk to all your listeners. Thank you so very much.
It was delightful for us as well. We're going to break now for CBS News. When we come back, we're going to hear some island steel drum music. How exciting is that? And then at 10:30, we've got a massive, massive cheese announcement. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. Now, I grew up in a steel town, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and when we referred to steel drums, they were drums that we stored stuff in, like cement. And there was always one of these drums out back. Then I moved to Miami in the subtropics, and steel drums took on a whole different meaning. Folks were banging them just so to create this islandy calypso music. Now, here's where it gets a little funky. I eventually moved to Oxford, Ohio, home of Miami University. And that school had a really fine steel drum band. A few weeks ago, when I asked for listener suggestions for the show, Mary Chappelle wrote to say that there was a steel drum band here in Vermont. Who'd have thunk? So let's get in the mood for this warm and sunny weather we're having this week by welcoming Island Time Steel Drums. Barb Smith, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you for having me.
And Scott Paulson, thanks for you for being here as well.
Hey, Rick, thanks so much for having us on.
Oh, absolutely. They are the members of Island Time Steel Drums. Listeners, to speak with the panists or maybe request a song, or you can give us a call if maybe you've heard them play out somewhere, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can always email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right. So I'm going to start with you, Scott. Are these drums or pans actually made from steel drums?
Totally made from steel drums. It's the bottom end of the barrel. There is one company that I'm aware of that actually makes the barrel itself from scratch because they make it oversized. But otherwise, they're all, you know, 22.5-inch diameter oil barrels. That's how they start out their lives anyway.
So they are all the same size that you play there?
Yep. All oil barrels are 22.5 inches in diameter. Of course, when they make them into drums, they're making them into different voices. So some are deeper, are caved in deeper than others are, depending on the voice that you're playing. But, yeah, they all came from standard barrels, for sure.
And then when you're standing there, how many do you have in front of you that you usually are playing?
I play what they call, well, they used to call it a tenor pan. Now it's more likely known as a lead pan, which is just a single drum. Barb plays a set of two called double second pans. And so actually the soprano voice of steel drum, she's playing like an alto voice.
And then do they have little dimples or bumps or something in them, or are they just real flat? What is that pan like?
So it's the first thing they do is called sinking. So they're on the bottom end of the oil barrel,
right?
And they start just hammering it until it's, you know, bowl shaped. Mine's probably about 10 inches deep in the middle because that's where the high notes are, so they have to stretch that metal a little bit more than they do on the outside ring. And Barb's aren't quite as deep as that because she's got lower notes.
Gotcha.
So they don't have to be stretched as far.
Barb, when did you start playing the steel drums?
Well, I moved back to Vermont after attending college and in 2001. And in 2002, I met Scott. He was starting a nonprofit arts organization in Sharon, Vermont, which is now known as Seven Stars Arts Center. And he was looking for other people, other musicians to come in and teach music. And at that time, he had a small steel band going called the Panhandlers Steel Band that is still in existence today, actually. And that's how we met. I was teaching at the School of Woodwinds, and he said, hey, I have this set of double second pans. You want to give it a try? And I did, and
I roped her in.
We've had a really great time over the past, 20 years almost, playing Pan in Vermont, but also have been able to go on the road and play in other parts of the country as well. So it's been great.
So you played what before you started playing the steel drums?
Flute and saxophone are my primary woodwind instruments, but I also teach clarinet as well.
Okay, but not any kind of percussion, correct?
Not any percussion. I did not come from a percussion background. I had to take drum set lessons in college for my degree, but that was really it.
Wow. And are they considered a percussion instrument, Beth?
They are, but very melodic, as you heard
right.
us playing Yellowbird in the intro. I mean, technically speaking, people would also call the piano a percussion instrument too, but...
Yeah, I guess.
The metallophone.
Metallophone.
Scientific term for it.
All right. So you've got some of the drums right in front of you. Am I correct?
He's got a lead pan now. Yep.
Okay. So why don't somebody, you know, start playing and maybe explain, you know, this is when I play up near the rim, or this is, you know, so we can kind of hear the difference of what's going on there.
Sure thing. So my lowest note is middle C. Not sure how well that'll come through, but so that's middle C. An octave above that is just above it. The notes all line up from the outside of the pan to the interior.
Mm-hmm.
So just above middle C is the C above that. And then one more octave above that. So, and as we go around, this is really interesting. Each note, musicians who are familiar with the circle of fifths will know what this means, but every note is five notes away from the one next to it. So if I go around the outside of the lowest notes, you'll hear.
Oh, that's very cool. Scott, when you started playing steel drums in Vermont, did you get a lot of blank stares?
A lot of head scratching, absolutely.
Okay.
You know, these two Vermonters, you know, playing these instruments, and, you know, we've played, I guess the most interesting stares we've gotten are, we've played weddings for, like, Jamaican families.
Mm-hmm.
So that gets some unusual looks. But we just love to play, and I feel like, you know, they get comfortable after a while.
Yeah.
Well, goes, but,
what is it, Scott, that attracts you to this instrument and this music?
Well, I've been playing. I'm a drummer, and I was a drummer first, and I went to college for double bass. And I like picking up different instruments, unusual instruments. I played with the Highland Pipes with the Catamount Pipe Band for 2 years. But it was conflicting with our steel drum gigs. But I like to pick up new instruments and try them.
Hmm.
And I was between bands and thought, well, what's something that this area doesn't have? You know? And I'd heard pans on a cruise several years earlier, and I thought, oh, what a cool instrument, and I'd love to try it. So there was a fellow who had a pan for sale that I found out about in Montpelier, and I went up, and I won't tell you the whole story, but it's pretty funny. He was building a boat in his basement, and he couldn't get it out when he got finished to sail to Trinidad. But he had two pans, and he could only take one. So I bought the other one and taught myself how to play it, and eventually started teaching other people how to play.
Is the boat still in the basement?
No, he got it to Trinidad.
Oh, my gosh.
He's back now. But he did. He built it in his basement. He sold it to sailed it to Trinidad, which is where steel drums are from.
Yeah.
And, had to knock down a wall.
Oh, my gosh. And now he just makes builds boats in a bottle. Hey, Beth.
I guess. That would be a lot easier.
Now, is the music that you play, is it all calypso style of music on these drums?
No, we do a mix of, like, traditional Trinidadian music. You know, of course, Yellowbird, that's Harry Belafonte.
Yeah.
Popular. But we do Americanized songs, too, you know. Oh, what are some American tunes we do?
We do Bang on the Drum.
Oh.
Todd Rundgren. Scott's sister arranged that song, actually. She played steel drums with us, too, for a while when she was living in Vermont.
Here Comes the Sun. It's probably about 50-50, just like pop tunes. And then some of the tunes from Trinidad are like panorama numbers that people wouldn't recognize.
Gotcha. But, Well, we're going to play another really one of your songs. Oh, go ahead, Beth.
We've been playing gigs, and we'll play a Bugsy Sharp song. He's a very famous calypsoan from Trinidad. And we'll be playing it in Burlington on the waterfront, and somebody will come up to us and know the song.
Oh, wow. Happen.
So it's I feel like there is a large, there are about 30 steel drum bands in New England right now, which most people don't know.
Wow, that's impressive. Let's play a song from y'all that people might recognize from television. All right, that is the theme song from I Dream of Jeannie, and that makes me so happy. When I saw that was a song that you all played, I just couldn't believe it. I think that's really phenomenal. Well, you mentioned, Beth, playing like on the waterfront in Burlington. What kind of gigs do you get hired for?
Well, we quite often get hired for, restaurant waterfront gigs. We also play a lot of graduation parties.
Wedding cocktail hours.
Yep. Mm-hmm. A lot of cocktail hours for weddings.
Incoming cruise ships?
We would love to do that down south. We have played down south in the Florida Keys for restaurants. Yeah, for happy hours. That's been quite fun.
Yeah, we've played a bunch of gigs on the Spirit of Ethan Allen also.
That totally makes sense. I could see that on a nice lake cruise and that music. That would be absolutely outstanding. Scott, we had a listener call in and said they're familiar with a band down in Yarmouth, Mass, Pan Fried Steel. You said there's about 30 of your steel drum bands here in Yarmouth, Mass, or Maine? Maine. And anyway. Maine.
We know that band, actually.
You know them, of course. I wondered, is there kind of a community, a fraternity, a sorority of, steel drum players? Do you all get to know each other?
Absolutely. Maybe not every member of every band in New England, but I know all the directors. And would you believe that there's a steel drum festival, which is usually the first weekend of May, that travels around, different people host it, around New England. So, and it's just like a get-together. We play for each other. We take turns playing. It's not a contest, just a camaraderie, fellowship, kind of, brothers and sisters in Pan. That draws up to 30 bands.
Oh, that's so neat.
We'll all set up in a hockey arena or something like that and just have a great, great time.
Beth, you said you picked it up about 20 years ago. Are you still learning? Is it an easy instrument to pick up and start to go? Or do you kind of learn something from it, every time you get in front of these pans?
Well, I think any instrument that you learn, you can take it to whatever degree you want to in terms of musicianship and improving. I think we are still learning. We actually were able to attend the Ellie Manette Festival of Steel in West Virginia. Ellie Manette is widely regarded as the first Trinidadian or the first man ever to put notes in a particular pattern on a steel drum. Mm-hmm. And the University of West Virginia hired him to start a pan program there. And so every summer they host this big workshop, and man, we learned a lot there.
Oh, that's fantastic!
It was very intense. We were playing with some of the best, working with some of the best pianists in the world: Ellie Manette,
Jeff Norell,
Andy Norell. These are people who are just really fine pan players and really great teachers. And it was a very intense educational week.
It was a week.
We played a lot of pan all day. I mean, it was like 6-7 hours of pan playing a day.
Oh, my.
And lectures at night.
It was really amazing.
Yeah. Do you have to, I think I would get tired after the first song because you're kind of reaching into this pan and hammering it. Barb, do you really have to be in shape? Do you have to work your guns and your forearms?
A little bit. I mean, I'm glad I don't play the bass pans. If you ever see videos of bass pans online, you can go to our website. I think we have some links there. But the set of bass drums is actually 6 full-sized oil drums, and one person stands in the middle of them.
In a circle.
In a circle, and is just playing backwards and behind and forward. That can be a workout.
Oh, sure. My goodness. Wow. That is something. Hey, let's go to the phones. We've got Rick joining us from Burlington. Morning, Rick.
Hey, how are you guys? Rick Norcross here, and I just wanted to...
Rick! Hey, Rick!
Hey, buddy. Yeah, thank you so much for having these guys on.
Yeah.
I've known and loved their music for years and years, and they're absolutely terrific, and if I was ever going to get married again, I'd hire them.
<That's>
Thank you so much, Rick. It's so great to hear your voice.
Rick, have you ever tried to play him?
God, no. I can see it's hard enough lugging all these guitars around, but having to roll a barrel to a gig would not be good for me.
Oh, I love
it. They're just terrific. We appreciate them so much, and they actually had a school for a while down in the Randolph area, and they've just been a huge influence in central Vermont for teaching other people to enjoy music, and every time I can, I go hear them.
Oh, that's great. Hey, Rick, thanks so much. Okay, it's great to have you. Rick was on with me, maybe about a month and a half ago, and it's great to hear from Rick Norcross again. Where are you based out of, Scott?
We're in Bethel.
Mm-hmm.
Bethel, Vermont. So
not too far from Riverside Farm or the
Liberty
farm.
Hill Farm.
Liberty Hill Farm.
Oh, yeah.
20
right.
minutes south of there.
Wow. I'm really hitting that beautiful little stretch right there today on the show. That's great. And Barb, I'm sorry I called you Beth a few minutes ago because my past former guest, the one right before, was Beth Kennett from Liberty Hill Farm. So.
Oh, that's fine. That's fine.
All right. I know you kind of hesitated. I'm thinking, what? Oh, I called her by the wrong name. So.
No, that's okay.
when you started, Barb, did it take right away, or did people who are skiers and try snowboarding say, why would I try this? I know how to play these other instruments. I'll just go back to skiing, or I'll go back, to what I know. I'm going back to the sax.
It did take a bit of time. And the thing that was so different for me was the note layout on the pans. It's not like you're playing a piano. And there's a very specific reason why. You don't have the notes C and D right next to each other on the pan because it wouldn't vibrate correctly to get the right tone out, to put it simply.
Uh-huh.
So when I first got my voice of pans, I had all the note names written in the spots. And over time, what happens is you develop muscle memory like you do playing any instrument. And you just kind of start, if you practice regularly, like every day, just start remembering where the notes are, and then it just starts to come naturally. It took maybe 6 months for me to feel like I was pretty fluid enough to play like an hour's worth of material.
Mm-hmm. Well, and another thing is not all the makers put the notes in the same places. Voice of drum. So if you buy the lead pan, the one that I play has become pretty standardized, but all the other ones, like if you, wear out a set of pans and you get another set, the notes may be in different places. You might have to like relearn the note layout, which is pretty hard to do.
And that did happen to me, but it was,
That's not fair.
scrambling the piano keys.
Are they costly, Scott?
They are. The ones we play, to get an entry level one that's actually fully chromatic, and they are fully chromatic, you can find kind of toy ones online for, $200, which is it's good for like classroom stuff, but they only play one scale. So if you want a fully chromatic, decent steel drum, entry would be around 1,000.
Okay. And then how do you care for them? I would imagine, Rick said you rolled them into a gig, but I would imagine you're a little more careful than that.
Yeah, a little more careful than that. They need to be tuned. People ask us a lot, do they need to be tuned? And then the next thing they ask is, do we do the tuning? And we do not. We actually hire, we mentioned Ellie Manette, a protege of his that comes up from West Virginia usually and goes through our pans. And the tuning is very complex because it's really not just the size of the space. It's actually the shape that they create within the space.
Mm-hmm.
And tuning is very complex. It takes about 8 years to get good at it. And it's a little costly. It's about $120 per voice. And back when I was running a 18-piece steel band, that ran into some serious change. to get them to them. So we only have it done generally once a year.
I got you.
That and Windex, you know, that's basically how we maintain the pans, and ours are chrome, so they're nice and shiny.
They are beautiful. They really have a great look to them. And then when you spot someone playing them and you see what they're generating from them, and then what is the hammer that you hit it with? What's that made of?
Our tuner has a variety of shapes of hammers, and it depends on what part of the process you're in. But they're just, you know, store-bought handers that have been ground into the right positions for, or right shapes for the notes he's working on.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I wish it were just as simple as, like, you hit the note from underneath and it gets higher, and you hit it from the top and it gets lower. But, yeah, there's a lot to it.
Oh, my. Barb, when you're at a dinner party and when, you know, when they were a thing, of course, and you drop the fact that this is your thing, what's the reaction you get from people?
Generally, people are just, they love it. I mean, I don't think we've ever played a gig where people have told us that they hated steel drums.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it surprisingly so, sometimes we'll play in small venues and they see us set up in a corner and they think we're going to be loud, and people have this misconception that steel drum bands are very loud, when in fact, you can play the pan quite quietly.
Mm-hmm.
The mallets that we use are just, they're rubber tipped mallets. So it's not like we're hitting it with like a...
Yeah, this is not taiko drumming.
Yeah, right. It's not taiko drumming.
That's right.
So it's, we enjoy it a lot. You know, I feel like when people come up to us and they have never heard the instrument or seen the instrument in person, but they've heard that sound before, and they never realized that that was the sound that they've heard on the radio was produced by this instrument.
Right.
It's pretty cool.
They say that they come up and they're like, I don't see where it plugs in.
That happens a lot.
Yeah.
Like they think it's electric or something.
Absolutely. It has almost like an amplified sound to it. Right. Scott, have you ever run into anyone who doesn't start to smile and shimmy and sway and dance when they hear your music?
Pretty much not. It's really hard to sit still. You know, at least you look out, and if they're eating dinner, you see a lot of toes tapping.
So yeah.
That's when we know we're doing something right.
And the kids love it. Oh, my gosh. That's what I noticed. Children, yeah. They love the sound.
Yeah, we've done a lot of workshops in schools. We call them informances, where we talk about the history and how they're made and do a bunch of playing, and the kids get to dance around if the teachers are in a good mood. you know, back in the day.
Yeah. And do you have to wear islandy costumes when you perform, or is that not required?
It depends on the gig. If we're out, you know, just playing like a town concert or something like that, yes, we wear the flowery shirts.
All right.
But, you know, we've also worn all black to, you know, more formal affairs or whatever the affair calls for. We've done a lot of playing for benefit auctions.
Oh, yeah.
And so we tend to get a little less islandy and more formal for that.
I got you. Scott Paulson, Barb Smith are members of Island Time Steel Drums. You can visit their website, islandtimesteel.com. And I want to thank you both for enlivening our morning and sending us out into the sunshine with this beautiful music. Thank you both.
Thank you so much, Rick. Enjoy the weather.
Sure thing. All right, we've got a CBS News update, and then we've got a big cheese announcement. I'm not sure if it's a large announcement about cheese or a big cheese in the cheese biz or a mammoth piece of cheese, but we'll find out in just a few minutes.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. So I was apprised yesterday that there would be a big, big cheese announcement today. And so I said, yes, of course, I want breaking cheese news here on Vermont Viewpoint. And so I had to wait to find out what it was until just moments ago. And now I realize why, because had I known through the full hour and a half of this program, I would have been drooling and would not have been able to conduct interviews with the previous guests. So I now have with me Roberta McDonald, Senior Vice President of Brand Strategy for Cabot Cooperative Creamery Cooperative. Roberta, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
I'm so happy to be here and understand your view too, Rick.
Yes. And Adam Farmer is the CEO of VCPI, which is Vermont Cheese Products, Inc. Adam, welcome to you as well.
Rick, good morning.
Good morning.
Appreciate you bringing me on.
Oh, I'm so happy now. First of all, Roberta, why don't you explain what the big cheese announcement is?
I hope Kenley's listening. You know, I miss it. We wanted very much for DEV to break this news. So this is a big deal. Cabot Creamery Cooperative is partnered with Adam and his company, and I want you to understand probably the term partner is too intimate in a legal sense, but we are collaborating with real Vermonters to bring out Cabot in a box, Cabot mac and cheese in a box. And it's something our farmers have wanted to do for a long, long, long time, but Adam made it possible to do it.
I cannot believe this. This is like, all of a sudden, my mind is just blowing up, and I cannot wait. I'm driving to the Cabot. I'm driving over to Cabot today. I'm going to stand outside the gates of the building and just wait for the first box from wherever it's coming from to land in my lap. So let's talk about this. Say it again. Tell people again, Roberta, what's happening.
Okay, we spent the last 3 decades with WDEV, our very first ad monies went to WDEV to let people know they could buy our cheddar cheese in the dairy case, right? Mm-hmm. We have never been able to say you can buy Cabot cheese on another aisle in the grocery store. So we have, and I don't want to mention any competition, but the idea that we can have pasta and Cabot cheese powder mm-hmm. in a little box that's shelf stable, that anybody can make in 10 minutes, my heart's pounding.
My knees are shaking. and, you know, I cannot believe this. As a matter of fact, Roberta, when I was at a previous station back in the early 2000s, I spoke to Marcel Gravel, and that was when you were coming out with the flavored cheeses, and I was so excited then. That was a massive announcement. Back in the early 2000s, right?
Right. It was untold crazies went wild. What? You put what in your cheddar? You have peppers? You have roasted garlic?
Yep.
What?
Yep.
They don't do that.
I remember asking Marcel, was there any, you know, flavor that didn't make the cut? And he said, yeah, we tried to do like a maple cheddar, and that didn't quite work, right? So.
Yeah, but Grafton does a great maple cheddar. And actually, we did a maple cheddar for a long time, but it had to be done at another location and literally dripped on wires. It's very messy.
Yeah, that's what he said. All right, so Adam Farmer, you are the CEO of something called Vermont Cheese Products, Inc., and it's almost like if I could create the best company name of any place in the world, Vermont Cheese Products, Inc. would be it. What exactly is Vermont Cheese Products, Inc., or VCPI?
All right. I definitely have to agree with you. The Vermont name carries some serious weight in the cheese world. So Vermont Cheese Products is a new company that we started that has a pretty specific goal. It's to launch the Cabot brand into new product categories. All of our partners, we're all Vermonters, we're super fond of the Cabot brand. And we look at these different categories that we're creating products in. All of them are cheese based, and all of the leading brands have no affiliation with the high quality brand name cheese like Cabot.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the mac and cheese space, I mean, you could say Kraft is a cheese company, but we all kind of know where people think of, you know, people think of Kraft mac and cheese, they think of fake. I mean, Annie's is a great brand, but still, you know, there's no Annie's blocks of cheddar. And Cabot has such an amazing following from here, you know, all over the Northeast down to Florida. People have such a strong affiliation for the brand, and we're like, we could see you doing quite well in these different product categories. So, I was calling a bunch of the farmers, and they pointed me in direction to Roberta. And then, Roberta, how long ago is it that we met now? What, a year and a half? I think it was.
Not Adam. It feels like forever. Because if you start talking when we started at the very top, I want to say it's 2 years at least, 2.5. And the reason I'm saying this is because we danced for a long, long time until I really took you seriously.
Yeah, Roberta had some doubts in the beginning, and I've said this before, I can't be so thankful that you're you know, entrusting us with the brand and letting us you know, sell products under the Cabot name. So back to what our company is. So all of our products are made with Cabot cheese. We buy our cheese from Cabot and convert it and process it into a usable ingredient for our mac and cheese. So right now we have our Seriously Sharp Rick. Mm-hmm. We also, coming down the line soon, we have Pepper Jack, mm-hmm. macaroni and cheese, and bacon cheddar. So all, like I said, all of it is made with aged Cabot cheese. And we use more cheese than anybody else as well. That's the thing. You know, if you look at what some of the other products are using, we have about 25% more than all the leading brands out there.
Mm-hmm.
We also got popcorn coming down the line, too. We got, back to what you guys were talking about, maple. We have a maple cheddar popcorn.
Oh.
Which, people have absolutely thought was delicious, where it's similar to the caramel. In half caramel, half cheese. We do like a half candy coated maple and a half cheddar cheese popcorn. But anyway, super excited about that. So that's kind of the high level overview of Vermont cheese. And the goal is to put the Cabot brand onto the into the dry goods area.
Oh my goodness! Yeah,
I really want Adam to speak about the people behind the Vermont cheese products, because what really puts us online to do this, and it's certainly not my permission that was given to use the brand, but rather the board of directors, who got very excited, mostly because of the promise of the people engaged in this enterprise. And so I think it's important that you understand, Adam, you know, these are all long-term Vermonters or committed to Vermont. Jeff Hollander is on the advisory board, seventh generation. Adam, tell them about the Farrells. I mean, being so engaged with this from the beginning.
Yes. Yeah, so we were, so Vermont Cheese Products. So we started it by our private equity firm called Alpine Summit Capital, which is a group of all Vermont business owners.
Hmm.
Farrell Distributing. They're a big investor and also an exclusive distributor. Throughout the state of Vermont, Brian Cairns, the people at Jiffy Mart, Hollander, a bunch of other big name Vermonters are not only putting in capital, but also opening up their expertise in this space to help grow the brand.
This is so exciting. First of all, I should come clean. Now, May 29th, I will have been in Vermont living here 18 years. And in that time, I have never, not one day, gone without my refrigerator being empty of Cabot cheddar, Cabot cheese. That is the honest truth. I was telling my director, Danny, I got down to one slice one time, and I had to run out because I would not let the streak end. And that has been to my absolute pleasure that I've kept it stock with Vermont cheddar. And I should also tell you that on Saturdays, my family has been doing a Zoom call, and last Saturday, my niece and her husband and family, they're in York, Pennsylvania, and they said that is their cheese of choice. They have to have Cabot cheddar in the house. So we have learned that Cabot will have a mac and cheese brand, which is exciting news. So I'm talking to Roberta McDonald. She's Senior VP of Brand Strategy for Cabot. I'm talking to Adam Farmer. He's the CEO of VCPI, which is Vermont Cheese Products, Inc. Roberta, I would imagine the employees and the owners, the farmer owners of Cabot Cooperative, have learned about this, and you've probably gotten some reaction. They must be absolutely over the moon made of cheese.
That was our first pasta, cows jumping over the moon. Rick, first of all, I want to thank you on behalf of all the farmers for your refrigeration loyalty. Family knows this is the truth. I actually go into refrigerators with friends and open the door to make sure that there is Cabot in the fridge. This is a gentle rule of thumb. And thanks to York.
They're no longer friends.
That's right.
Exactly.
Why do I know this person? That's right.
I want you to know that this is the first announcement. You're getting this. The social team leaked a little bit about this on Facebook. So unless you see Facebook, you don't know. There are some employees that are actually packing it up to ship it to every farmer today. So that the annual meeting, it arrives before the annual meeting, which is the big rollout to the membership that this is happening.
Oh,
so this is an exclusive that we're giving you.
Oh, my goodness.
This is in deference to all the years, I think, of music to go to the dump by. I think for the birds, Brian Pfeiffer, Anton Tebbets. I think of a history with Tenley and his crazy cockamamie, I want to own a radio station. It's so incredibly appropriate that this breaking news, Cabot jumps out of the dairy case onto the shelf, had to happen with WBEV.
Well, you know what else is appropriate? The studio I'm sitting in, there's these shelves with all kinds of little knickknacks. Of course, there's a Cabot stress cow up there sitting above me. So that's another appropriate item there. Now, Adam, I would imagine that it took some work, though, to develop this mac and cheese to make sure that it is spot on correct.
It did. It took some trial and error. We probably did about my family members and friends are probably getting sick of mac and cheese. I'm like, all right, you got to try this one. You know, blind taste test. This one is this versus Annie's. And then, a few formulations, we found something that we really think elaborates on Cabot's cheeses. Like, once you try it, not only, like I said, is there more cheese, it's noticeably sharper. Our mac and cheese is seriously sharp, and people can immediately pick it, tell the difference.
Oh, I love that so much.
So we've been getting great feedback on it so far. I want to figure out how we can do some sort of, like, official taste test that, like, 1,000 people out of 1,000 pick ours over the leading beans. But there's certain rules around that. But
yes, there are.
Yeah, no, it's it took some time. You know, we had to get the right cheese mix. So there's a different mix of cheeses that we use, different ages, different grades, to get a real consistent flavor profile. But Cabot's been super helpful. I got to give a shout out to Ryan Littlefield over there, Roberta. He's been working on this from the beginning with us. And, it's just been awesome in helping get us the cheese that we need for products.
It's Brian Littlefield, who is my brother in all things having to do with the license. But I think of Frank Mem and the hours sweating the legal issues and Julie Nodler going to all these plants to make sure they could protect the brand. So Adam's really downplaying, Rick, how much time and effort he put into developing the product to pass muster.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you that senior staff, lots of people knew this in every iteration. And it's very interesting. If you're a Northeastern child, you love this.
But if you've had, if you've been used to a really bland yellow product that we won't mention, that sounds like the guy that used to own the Patriots. Never mind. What I want you to know is that they still like it. And I don't have a single grandparent in our case population whose children didn't go for the right package. But I think it's because of the box. It is such a cool-looking, crazy-ass box.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big Cabot logo. And then there's Cal Prince. They brought back my Cal Prince Cal Spot. So
brilliant.
That's a really good throwback to the original Cabot kind of quirky packaging. So I don't know. It's very exciting for us. Possibly silly. I think Adam thought this was going to make CBS, and he said, no, if it makes CED, we're golden.
Oh, how beautiful. Adam.
Robert always, I'm guilty of being overly optimistic in a lot of things, and Roberta brings me down to earth.
Does that mean buzzkill, Adam? What are you really saying?
That's true, yeah. Hey, Adam.
I think that's what you said yesterday.
Let's tell people, when they can start to see this on shelves. And, first, I think it's the Seriously Sharp, maybe the other varieties. What's the timeline?
So Seriously Sharp is actually on shelves now in a few Vermont independent retailers.
Hmm.
So like I said earlier, Farrell's our exclusive distributor in the state. And so he's been going out. And their company has been working with all the individual independent stores. So I believe it's going to be in the bigger ones at the start of next week. So City Markets, the Healthy Livings of the world. It's going to be in Price Chopper and Big Y on the 15th. And those are the first larger box retailers that we're going to be working with. And then in the summer, we're going to be planning to expand to the rest of New England.
All right. And Seriously Sharp to start with. Now, you mentioned some other flavors, bacon cheddar. There's the pepper jack. Do those follow, or are they in the stores immediately?
Right now it's just Seriously Sharp.
Yep.
The other flavors, we're planning to have them online, at least in Vermont, when we go to the rest of New England, so in the beginning of the summer.
Okay.
And
then popcorn?
I think Pepper Jack is going to be the
Oh, I know.
I think Pepper Jack one came out really good. You haven't tried that one yet, Roberta. I'm excited to give it to you.
anything. This is
what I want you to
know is how hard it is. That's why Adam's doing something that you won't see anywhere on the shelf, which is putting the famous Cabot flavors into the mac and cheese.
Mm-hmm.
The reason you don't see it is nobody has figured out how to do it. So that's why everything's so bland.
Right.
And he'll be working on a gluten-free because we do honor that population issue. But more than anything, he's given us something. The farmers have a way. His company is taking all the risk, all the costs, all the distribution. This allows our farmers to make a royalty, if you will, on every box sold. And that means income to the farmers, plus it's their cheese in the box. So this is a wildly significant change in our way of doing business that's pretty positive. And to have concluded it during COVID, I'd say right on, right?
Oh, no kidding. Wow. Add that in. And it is amazing that you pulled it off. I, first of all, want to thank you both for being on. I want to thank you for making the exclusive announcement, the big cheese announcement right here on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV this morning. But most of all, I want to thank you for creating this product. There is nothing that will make me happier for the rest of the year than to know this. 2020 was a terrible, terrible year. 2021 is now the greatest year of my life, thanks to the two of you. And that is phenomenal. We're going to have mac and cheese from Cabot, and I don't think there's better words that can be uttered. So thank you both. Roberta McDonald is Senior Vice President of Brand Strategy at Cabot. Adam Farmer is the CEO of VCPI, that's Vermont Cheese Products, Inc. Thanks for being with us.
Appreciate
you.
Appreciate
you
having us on, Rick.
All right, take care. All right. Boy, we had, what do we have today? Dogs, cows. We had beautiful island music and then the great cheese announcement. What a day it's been. And that is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint, produced by Shayla Condor Shapiro, directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And feel free to suggest topics or break big news if you've got big cheese announcements. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. We've got Bill Sayre up next with Common Sense Radio. I'm Rick Sengary. I will meet you back here tomorrow.